Beliefs in Physics, Some Lessons from Ancient Greek Science, Robert C. Newman, abstract of this talk, A Sketch of Ancient Greek Physics from Thales to Aristotle, reveals a strong interaction between metaphysical beliefs and the practice of physics, an interaction working in both directions. Metaphysical views suggested and inhibited questions and approaches to the physical realm, and physical observations and experiments favored or disfavored various metaphysical views. Some lessons are suggested regarding how we should view current theories in modern physics. How do our beliefs and our science interact? Well, that can be discussed in various ways. We want here to look at a case study of ancient Greek physics, starting with Thales and coming down to Aristotle. Their science today seems to us to be crude, rash, absurd, but then, how will our science look just 200 years from now? We want to look first of all at the physical substratum and ask the question, what is the most basic substance out of which everything is made? Thales, flourishing about 585 BC, believed that the most basic substance was water. Anaximander, about a generation later, believed the most basic substance was a apeiron. And Anaximander, living about 20 years after that, believed that the most basic substance was air. Thales was a practical thinker. He's reputed to have made contributions to law, politics, civil engineering, math, and astronomy. Like others of the pre-Socratic philosophers, our information about him is indirect, and so we're not sure of the ins and outs of these sort of things. Thales was even credited with predicting an eclipse of the sun. Thales thought that water was the basic substance behind all other phenomena. We really do not know for sure why he came to this conclusion. Perhaps he was aware of the necessity of moisture for life. Perhaps he knew water could be solid, liquid, and vapor. I suspect that idea was fairly well known at that time. We do see that Thales preferred natural selection explanations to supernatural explanations. Thales, however, was not an atheist. He perhaps had been observing agriculture and industry where basically natural technology, if you like, is able to make some substantial differences. Anaximander, flourishing about 555 BC, was a student of Thales. He believed in a single universal substance, but rejected water as being this universal substance. Perhaps it was because he could not see water as a source of fire. Instead, Anaximander proposed a rather abstract sort of substance as the universal substance. He called it apeiron, which is Greek word for a thing that is unlimited or infinite or boundless. The idea of his abstract substance was that it contained in itself all the opposites. Anaximenes, flourishing about 535 BC, was also from the Asia Minor area of Greek settlement, the city of Miletus, as were Thales and Anaximenes. They are known as the Milesian philosophers as well as the pre-Socratic philosophers. Anaximenes favored a single ultimate substance, but in contrast to Anaximander, he moved back to an observable material, namely air. He viewed rarefied air as being fire, and condensed air as becoming wind, or with more condensation, cloud, or with more water, or with more earth, or finally stone. The Milesian cosmologies were based upon their physics. They saw the nature of the universe as founded on this basic substance. So Thales believed that the earth floats on water. Anaximander, that the earth was cold and the heaven fiery, two different, which were manifestations of his apeiron, and it was formed by separation from the apeiron. Anaximenes believed that the earth floats on air and that the wind pushes the stars around. What can we say about Milesian physics? Well, the historian of sciences Lloyd says this about it: the history of Milesian views about the primary substance is chiefly remarkable for the way in which the awareness of the problem grew from one philosopher to the next. Their actual theories strike a later age as childish, but the measure of their achievement is the advance they made in grasping the problems. They rejected supernatural causation and appreciated that naturalistic explanations can and should be given for a wide range of phenomena. They took the first tentative steps toward an understanding of the problem of change. We move to a second question, a mathematical substratum. Is there some sort of organizing principle behind things? So we thought, first of all, about the physical substratum. Is there some basic underlying substance? Now, is there some sort of organizing principle behind things? Here, the Pythagoreans, flourishing from 525 BC and onward, felt that reality is number. Plato, from nearly two centuries later, about 350, felt that reality is unchanging ideas. Well, the Pythagoreans. It's hard to separate Pythagoras' views from his followers, because again, we have his information, his beliefs only through his followers and later commentators. But Pythagoras observed that harmony in sound, music, comes from vibrating strings that have links of simple ratios. And he proposed then that reality consists of numbers. His followers, the Pythagoreans, became a sort of religion. Pythagoras' suggestion led to the increased interest in the form rather than the substance of matter. And these ideas have proved fruitful for research in the centuries following the time of Pythagoras and the Pythagoreans. We have developed the importance of numerical measurement. How numbers can we reduce a particular feature or quantity to? We've developed the idea of mathematical modeling, that somehow we can make mathematical pictures of some sort that allow us to understand features of reality, etc. And within just a few centuries, Pythagoras's suggestions led to substantial advances in the area of astronomy, being able to do numerical things with the movements of the stars and their positions and that sort of thing. However, the ideas of Pythagoras and his followers also led to a great deal of mumbo-jumbo, number mysticism of various sorts. The idea of the mystical significance of not only numbers, but of shapes, geometrical shapes and things of that sort. Plato flourishes about 350 BC. He was influenced by the Pythagoreans. And when he set up his study group, we might call it the Academy, to become a member of his academy, one needed to understand geometry. He realized fairly quickly that geometric drawings are only approximations of the ideas behind them, that it's very hard to draw a perfect circle, but it's not hard to define a perfect circle, that it's virtually impossible to draw a line that is tangent to a circle that meets it only in one point, though, again, it is not hard to imagine what a tangent is. And from this idea that geometric drawings are only approximations of the ideas behind them, Plato expanded this to reality as a whole. Reality is only an approximation to the ideas behind it. Plato also gathered many followers over the centuries, whom we call Platonists. And Plato and the Platonists believe then that ultimate reality consists of eternal, unchanging ideas. A theme that has been popular off and on even up until the 20th century. The Platonists also believe that these ideas are only imperfectly represented in the changing world of sense experience. The upshot then is that true knowledge is knowledge of these eternal ideas rather than knowledge of the unreliable sensory data. Well, that much for structure of things. We turn to a third topic, motion in vacuum. How can motion be reconciled with a single universal substance? One has a single universal substance that is everywhere and fills everything. How can anything move? Well, various answers were given to that in antiquity. The philosopher Parmenides, flourishing about 480 BC, basically said, motion is an illusion because there is no vacuum. There is nothing to for the substances to move around in. Zeno followed him about a generation later, and he basically said motion is not only an illusion, it's absurd. It's logically impossible, etc. Empedocles, a contemporary of Zeno, moved in a different direction. He felt that there was not a single universal substance. There were four substances, which between them made up everything, earth, water, air, and fire, and their relative movement or conversion from one to another, or movement among one another, I think would be a better way of saying it, was the way you got motion. Anaxagoras, from the same period, believed there were actually an infinite number of elements, and so you didn't have the single universal substance. And lastly, the atomists believed that indeed, although atoms were the universal substance in one sense, there also existed a vacuum, nothingness, and the atoms moved around in this vacuum. Well, let's look at each of these. Parmenides, flourishing about 480 BC, asked the question, how can motion be reconciled with a single universal substance? He basically said it can't. He held to the single universal substance and rejected motion. So Parmenides denied the reality of motion, and since it looked like to everybody that motion was actually going on, Parmenides denied the testimony of human senses. Zeno of Elea, a disciple of Parmenides, constructed several very clever arguments to show that motion cannot exist. We have heard perhaps of Zeno's paradox, the idea of a race between a very fast runner and a very slow moving object like a turtle, and Zeno basically argued that you give the turtle a head start, and suppose it gets about 10 meters out ahead of the runner, and now the runner starts off. But by the time the runner has reached where the turtle was at the start, the turtle has moved on further, and then the runner has to run further to catch up with that, and by the time he gets there, the turtle has moved on further. And so Zeno argued that the runner will never catch up with the turtle. Well, this sort of argument and several others of the same sort were often ignored, but they were not really refuted till the invention of calculus about 2,000 years later. Empedocles, flourishing at the same time, gave one response to Zeno and Parmenides, and that was to have several basic substances rather than just one, and those then moving among themselves. Empedocles proposed that matter was a mixture of four things: earth, water, air, and fire. Changes or motion took place when the compositions or positions of these elements changed, and this was caused by two forces which he called love and strife, and which physicists of later centuries would call attraction and repulsion. This model, in fact, became the dominant view of physics until modern times. Four elements and being able to make compounds of different of these four elements and to attract and repel and such. Anaxagoras, also flourishing at the same time, about 445 BC, carried the pluralistic idea to an extreme. He argued that there are an infinite number of different sorts of things, and so when a human eats fruit, the body extracts flesh and bone particles from the fruit, and puts them together to form flesh and bone inside the human. Anaxagoras' model was too complex to be very influential. Eucippus, from about 435 BC, gave the best ancient solution to Parmenides' problem. He is the first of the atomists, and he suggests that reality consists of one eternal substance, but this comes in invisibly small particles. These particles are called atoms because they cannot be divided, the Greek a, not, and tomeo, to divide. Indivisible. That's the best ancient solution to Parmenides' problem. You might have been wondering what the modern solution to Parmenides' problem was, how you answered Zeno's paradox. And the answer there is that Zeno says that the runner will never catch up with the turtle, he's made a mistake. He has, in fact, divided up the problem into an infinite number of smaller and smaller pieces. And so there are an infinite number of them, an infinite number of pieces of distance, and an infinite number of pieces of time necessary to cover that distance. But what he didn't realize was that these infinite number of pieces of distance add up to a finite distance, the distance at which the runner overtakes the turtle, and the all these infinite number of pieces of time add up to a finite sum of time, the time it takes for the runner to catch up with the turtle. And this was the solution proposed and worked out in calculus, and that does indeed solve the problem, that we can imagine dividing up something in an infinite number of pieces, but that does still not mean that those infinite number of spatial pieces cover an infinite amount of space, or that the infinite number of time pieces cover an infinite amount of time. Now we move on to Democritus, still discussing the atomists, flourishing about 410 BC. The atomic idea was developed further by Democritus and then by Epicurus. The atoms are separated from one another by this void or vacuum, so motion is possible. Epicurus, around 300 BC, noted that the objects we experience are formed by chance combinations of atoms. And that was basically the idea. All the diversity we see are combinations of atoms, but they're chance combinations. And so the ancient atomic theory had no explanation but necessity for large-scale organization. Where does large-scale organization come from? The Pythagoreans and the Platonists said it comes from eternal ideas, but Epicurus could only say, and his followers, it comes from necessity. In some sense, that argument is still going on today. We turn lastly to the physics of Aristotle. And by the time of Aristotle, in late 300s BC, advances in astronomy had made it clear that we live in a pretty large universe. And so Aristotle developed what we would call a two-realm physics, a physics that was different beyond the moon and below the moon, superlunar and sublunar. In the superlunar realm, no changes took place, and there was only circular motion, and a fifth substance existed called the ether. In the sublunar realm, below the moon, change takes place. Motion is all vertical motion, though it can be made sideways in various ways, but the tendency is for vertical motion, and there are the four elements we mentioned earlier: earth, water, fire, air, and fire. Physics Aristotle, besides having the four elements that we had seen developed earlier, had four kinds of causation. It had a causation that we call material causation. What is something made of? So we could think of perhaps a sword. The material that the thing is made of is, let's say, iron, perhaps modified in certain ways to make it steel. The material cause of the sword is iron. Formal cause, how is it structured? The sword has a long blade, we would say, sharp on one or two sides, and a handle, and perhaps a guard, and that sort of thing. That would be the formal causation. The efficient causation, what forces were involved, and in this particular case, these would be presumably forces involved in making it, so the kind of forces that a blacksmith would appreciate, plus addition of a craftsman for making the handle and that sort of thing. And finally, the final cause, what is the purpose of this thing? That this object has a purpose behind it, and that purpose is presumably to be a weapon for offense or defense, and designed to be able to slice or to stick in an opponent. So those would be the four kinds of causation. Material, it's made of iron, steel, whatever, horn or wood or something for the handle. It's structured by a blacksmith to have a particular shape and such. Forces involved, the heat and the hammering and such. And the final cause, what was its purpose? There's been a tendency in modern science to ignore or reject final causation, rejecting the idea that there's a purposer out there, or to say in biology that purpose is merely apparent, and that the complicated structures of living things aren't really designed. They only look like they're designed. Well, this two-realm view of reality, superlunar, sublunar, and the four-cause view, material, formal, efficient, and final, of reality were strongly influential until modern times, as this combination provides both some consistency and believable explanations for many, many things. Well, that's our tour of early Greek physics. Now we want to come back and think about the interactions between beliefs and physics, between metaphysics and physics, as we might say it. And we want to ask these kind of questions. How were physical concepts used to develop and evaluate beliefs? How were metaphysical beliefs used to develop and evaluate physical concepts and theories? And how do shared beliefs of the science community influence its research agenda? Science community may be a little, what should we say, anachronistic, but certainly there were people who were interested in what these Greek scientists were doing at their time and knew something about what was going on and were in fact engaged in various sorts of things. It was not the kind of community that we've got today because it wasn't funded in the huge way it is by governments as it is today, an event that is only perhaps 150 or so years old in some senses. So let's look at the first of these. How were physical concepts used to develop and evaluate beliefs? Well, we mentioned that Thales may have been influenced to suggest a natural causation by thinking about agriculture and industry. So we can suggest that the techniques of craftsmen may have suggested natural causes to Thales. We weren't back there. We don't have detailed writing of Thales' thoughts, but only secondhand information. But that's certainly a fair suggestion there. Techniques of craftsmen may have suggested natural causes to Thales. We have good evidence that harmonious sounds produced by strings may have suggested to Pythagoras that number is the ultimate reality, that he was struck by this simple mathematical relationships between strings under the same sort of tension, that simple mathematical relationships are links to these harmonious sounds. Geometric drawings as rough approximations apparently convinced Plato that ideas were ultimate reality. You can see here then, techniques of craftsmen, harmonious sounds produced by strings, geometric drawings as rough approximations had influences on Thales and the Pythagoras and Plato, etc. Some other examples. A reluctance to abandon sensory evidence kept many from following Parmenides. Parmenides was kind of the doctrinaire theoretician par excellence. When he got an idea and it contradicted observation, he just said, so much the worse for observation. But most people have not been like that. And so reluctance to abandon sensory evidence kept many from following Parmenides and proposing instead models of reality in which change and motion are real. Moving on, astronomical evidence that the heavenly bodies were at great distances together with a scheme of reducing heavenly motion to circles, led Aristotle to his distinction between the earthly and the heavenly realms. So again, some input from observation, perhaps some input even here from a theoretical scheme that seemed to work rather well, led Aristotle into the idea of all the circular motion up there, whereas down here you've got gas rising, water going down to its lowest level and that sort of thing, working out the vertical motions. Well, that much for the first question. The second question, how are metaphysical beliefs used to develop and evaluate physical concepts and theories? We're turning the thing around the other direction. So on the first hand, physical concepts, theories influencing metaphysical beliefs. Now, metaphysical beliefs influencing physical concepts and theories. Well, the Milesian metaphysic of natural causation led to their suggesting various natural explanations instead of supernatural ones. Once they found that something looks like it's working in certain cases, they began to push it harder, if you like. It also led to speculations regarding a most basic substance. This led to attempts to study the basis of matter. So metaphysical beliefs having some influence on what we would call scientific studies. It also led to unwarranted optimism that the nature of the substratum could be easily found. Part of the history of science has been idea of some sort that seems fruitful has then been pushed and pushed, and frequently it runs beyond what there's warrant for, and one becomes unwarrantedly optimistic that a certain result can be used everywhere. My own feeling that this is part of what has happened in modern science. The realization that naturalistic explanation works well in many cases has led to a push to make it be the whole story, if you like. Well, we see that here as well. Obviously, the early physicists were nowhere near the substratum in physics, etc. We're not sure we are, but they weren't. How were metaphysical beliefs used to develop and evaluate physical concepts and theories? Some more. Pythagorean metaphysic of number has proved very fruitful in some fields, especially in introducing math as a tool in scientific research and theorizing. However, it also led to considerable number speculation, where the subject being investigated was either not hospitable to such an approach at that time, or perhaps not hospitable at all. Plato's view led him to devalue observation and experiment in favor of abstract reasoning. And so Plato's approach tends to disconnect theory from observation. That has perhaps been some tendency in theoretical physics over the centuries, and it can have good and bad results, if you like. Parmenides' view that motion was logically impossible led him to reject the contrary testimony of the senses. A pretty fierce sort of response there, huh? Democritus' view of atoms led him to a number of striking insights mixed with numerous unwarranted speculations, which he climbs out on limbs about the shapes of atoms and such, for which he'd got really no evidence at all. Democritus' strongly reductionistic explanations ignored the possibility of higher levels of structure and design in nature. Atomism, as you recall, really did not come up with any explanation of where you get higher level structure and whether there might be design in nature. The completeness and consistency of Aristotle's two-realm models with two types of physics had long-term and largely negative effects on the study of physics, which were not overcome till the late Middle Ages. Aristotle had seemed to have done such a complete job that until experimental work regained after the Dark Ages some competence and began to reinvestigate some of these things, it didn't become apparent there were some severe problems with Aristotle's view. By the time of Plato and Aristotle, we have something else going on which I've not mentioned, and that's the class divisions in the Greek society had widened to the point that the leisure class wanted nothing to do with physical labor and looked down on it and such, And the upshot of that was basically that the leisure class tended to approach physics and other sciences from a theoretical perspective and look down on physical labor, such as we would characterize technology as being involved in. Well, this had a negative effect on any research which looked practical and devaluated the physical studies that would later transform Western society. In a sense, centuries after Plato and Aristotle, it's the combination of the idea that physical labor is a good thing and not to be looked down upon, and the idea that there's a mind behind the universe that does things in a logical way, that led to the development of modern science, where theory and experiment came back together, if you like, and later transformed Western society. How did the shared beliefs of the science community influence its research agenda? Well, the Milesian search for purely natural explanations encouraged experiment and observation, but made it difficult to explain the existence of order in nature. The Pythagorean concentration, on the other hand, on math, produced impressive results where this was possible at the time, but rather fantastic number mysticism elsewhere. Plato's Academy tended to produce abstract logical constructions. This both helped and hindered astronomy, but tended to hinder in the other sciences. Plato's view of eternal forms gave better explanations of order in nature than the purely natural causation of the Milesians and the Atomists. Aristotle's proposal of four types of causation, matter, structure, energy, purpose, made better sense of the order in nature. Together with his emphasis on observation, this led to some effective biological research in his Lyceum and in later centuries. Well, that's our tour of early Greek physics. We want to come back and think about whether some of this has some lessons for today. I've already seeped over into that a little bit in earlier comments there, but let's think about some things that might be significant there. Given a hierarchical structure to reality, the idea that humans are made up of cells, and cells are made up of biochemicals, and biochemicals are made up of atoms, and atoms are made up of neutrons, protons, electrons, and neutrons and protons are made up of quarks, etc., and then going up beyond us, that above the size of humans, we have planets and stars and galaxies and galaxy clusters and such. Given a hierarchical structure to reality, is there any reason to believe that an empirically constructed bottom-up metaphysics, starting where we are and going upward in size scale to view the big things and downward in size scale to view the little things, is there any reason to believe that an empirically constructed bottom-up metaphysics will be anything more than accidentally correct before the final physics is discovered, before you discover what the universe as a whole looks like, or before you discover what the ultimate substratum is, what the ultimate forces are, etc.? And if that's so, then there's some real danger of extrapolations. Not that you don't need to make them, not that it's not all right to make them, but it's wrong to give too much credence to them. Huh? Next, the question of Occam's razor. How does Occam's razor influence physics? If you've seen the film Contact, based on Carl Sagan's science fiction novel, you see Occam's razor comes up again and again. Occam's razor is the name for a late medieval principle that the explanation that uses the fewest elements to explain things is to be preferred. How does Occam's razor influence physics? Do we tend to jump to unwarranted conclusions about the completeness of very preliminary theories? I think the answer is yes, the proponents of those theories do, And yes, the disciples of those theories do. And for a new theory that suddenly explains a lot of things, those guys get all the following, even though more cautious people who say, hey, wait a minute, may be ignored and turn out in some sense to be right in the long run. In the area of kinematics, motion, etc., is it reasonable to believe that nature can be limited to three spatial dimensions and one time dimension, such as we see in modern relativity theory? Well, when I first wrote this years ago, that's about what was being discussed. And since then, we've now gone up to some suggestions of 10, 11, and even more dimensions in order to do something with string theory and that sort of thing. That's all still very speculative. But it's a response to the previous one. We don't know for sure how our universe is put together. Yes, the three spatial dimensions we have some very strong significance. We can see how certain things work, that there's only three accessible dimensions in some sense. And yet, whether that's the whole story or not, don't know. Is it reasonable to believe it? Well, yeah, it's reasonable, but it might be wrong. Okay? Some significance to thinking in that direction. In the area of dynamics, is it reasonable to believe that the four currently known forces are all that exist? We're thinking of electromagnetism, gravity, the strong nuclear interaction, the weak nuclear interaction. Is it reasonable to believe that they're all that exist? And again, when I wrote this, there was no hint of anything else existing at that point. Now there's a possibility that the accelerating expansion of the universe, which seems to be holding up now with empirical observation, might be due to a fifth force, might be due to some peculiar behavior of gravity, perhaps. So is it reasonable to believe it? Well, it certainly was reasonable to believe it back then, but it might have been wrong, and perhaps a little less reasonable to believe it now. And then, secondly, is it reasonable to believe that they all exist and that they may be unified into one single superforce? Well, we have evidence that electromagnetism and the weak force can be combined, the electroweak force, and yet combining that with a strong force in gravity, sort of the holy grail of physics, well, it's reasonable, but it might not be so. And how hard do you push the idea that it all must be simple, that it all must be some single force? That may be an extrapolation beyond what we've got not only any warrant for, but coming off of a wrong idea of some sort. You have to look and see. In the area of dynamics, is it reasonable to believe that knowing the ultimate particles and physical forces will be sufficient to explain reality without recourse to special initial or boundary conditions? If you know the ultimate particles and know the physical forces, is that enough? Or are they put together some particular way? Has there been some kind of intervention, etc.? Well, again, modern science is operating kind of on the idea that if you got this, it'll be sufficient. That's, again, kind of your holy grail sort of thing. Christians, at least, might have some reason to believe that there's more to it than that. We don't know for the details of how that works. It's a question of how God has put the universe together, but we have strong reason to believe, as non-Christian secularists reject, that there's a God that's out there, a mind behind the universe, and that he needs to be taken into account, that final causes are, in fact, something very significant to understanding the universe. In the area of dynamics, is it reasonable to believe that the universe is an automaton, like a clock, that runs by itself, whether accidental or designed, or it may be an instrument, like a guitar, that is designed for input? This kind of touches on the previous one. Even if there's a God out there, has he designed the universe as an automaton, rather as the deists thought? We're here getting into 18th century physics or philosophy, if you like. Or an accidental automaton, such as modern secularists think, or is the universe something that is designed to have input, and that God plays it like a video game or something of that sort? If you're worldview is secularism, then you, quote, know that the universe is accidental, and that if the universe is defined in a truly universal way, it must be an automaton because there's nothing else to run it. But if that worldview is wrong, then even if it is an automaton, it may be a designed automaton, and beyond that, it may be an instrument for input of some sort. And that is something I think needs investigation, and I don't know whether we're going to have any success getting scientists to investigate it. Secular governments certainly aren't willing to put up money to investigate that sort of thing, and the mindset of secular science today is certainly not open to that sort of idea either. Well, that's the end of our discussion here. We suggest from this little tour, case study if you like, of early Greek science, that we can learn something about science from studying its history, and that that can be a valuable sort of thing to us in our thinking through what reality is all about. Thanks for your attention.